Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's Merger Monday, ladies and gentlemen. Dollar stores, online real estate sites. Plus, Russia is on the hook for $50 billion. And what happens when a major city threatens to shut off the water? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdal. It's Monday, the 28th of July, and it's great to have you with us. I mentioned a moment ago that it's Merger Monday. During the housing bubble, websites focused on the real estate sector sprung up like for sale signs in a hot neighborhood. And then, as the market got hotter, those small real estate companies started merging and buying each other out. Today came the biggest deal yet. Zillow agreed to buy rival Trulia for about $3.5 billion. The pair will create the proverbial 800-pound gorilla for online real estate. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has the story.
Always be consolidating seems to be the mantra for the online real estate sector. In the last couple years, Zillow snapped up New York apartment site StreetEasy and HotPads. Trulia bought Market Leader and last month was rumored to be close to buying Realtor.com. Nick Ritsinas teaches real estate at the Harvard Business School. He says when it comes to online real estate, bigger is pretty much always better.
In internet-based economy, scale matters a lot. And as the two largest players in this marketplace, the possibility of their coming together gave them some of the advantages of scale.
Together, Zillow and Trulia will command more than 60% of online real estate traffic. That mega market share is a big part of the reason we're seeing this deal, says Glenn Kalman, CEO of real estate site Redfin.
As one company takes a leadership position, it amasses enormous capital. And so you see Wall Street really rewarding the number one player in the space, and that gives them the capital to buy other companies.
The real estate market is recovering slowly, but the online real estate space is booming. Redfin is growing by 50% a year. Richard Green directs the USC Lusk Center for Real Estate. He says that growth is only going to pick up as more people get online and the internet generation comes of home buying age.
People do love to look at what their house is worth, and let's face it, they want to know what their neighbor's house is worth.
Still, Green doesn't think we'll see many more mergers of this kind. He says most of the deals that could be done have been done. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Another big deal is taking place at the Dollar Store. Their business is based, of course, on bargains. Dollar Tree has agreed to buy Family Dollar for about $8.5 billion. The thinking was the recession and the long, slow recovery that followed would mean business at all dollar stores would be strong. Well, Sally Herships tells us how Family Dollar ended up on the wrong side of the retail counter.
Seems like there's really only one reason consumers shop at a dollar store. Low prices, right?
One would think that a dollar store would be at an everyday low price.
Joe Feldman is a senior research analyst with Telsey Advisory Group. He says, unlike its name, Family Dollar sells products for lots of different prices, which may not be what consumers are looking for.
Maybe they're not shopping at Family Dollar. They may be shopping at Dollar General.
But Feldman says the entire dollar store industry has slowed down this year. Middle and upper middle class consumers can now afford to shop somewhere else. Robert Campanino is head of consumer research at SSR. He says dollar stores have started selling higher margin discretionary items, which can mean a problem. If there is a recovery, he says lower income consumers are not feeling it.
So what's happened when their consumer's been under pressure, that higher margin category has been where the sales weakness has been.
And even some staples are hard, like food, which dollar stores have been getting into. Sandeep Dahiya teaches finance at Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business.
The operations involved in selling something that has low shelf life is very different than selling soap. Soap doesn't go bad. If that 3-pound chuck doesn't get sold today, tomorrow it'll be thrown out.
Family Dollar says its sale means a good deal for shareholders, employees, and shoppers. Joe Feldman says dollar stores, all of them, just need to continue to make sure they have the right price. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, Family Dollar was up 25% after Dollar Tree announced plans to buy them. Not a whole lot happening on the rest of Wall Street. Details when we do the numbers.
We'll be right back.
The U.S. and Europe announced today they've agreed to impose more economic sanctions on Russia, a punishment for the more direct role Russia has taken in the war in Ukraine. The sanctions will target Russia's financial, defense, and energy sectors, and what they impose is expected to hurt U.S. and European interests. There was other bad news for Russia today. An international court says Russia acted improperly when it confiscated the assets of the oil company Yukos more than a decade ago. The ruling handed down today would require Russia to pay $50 billion to former Yukos shareholders. BBC Economics correspondent Andrew Walker joins us now. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, David.
$50 billion, this is a big penalty, not small potatoes, as we'd say here. What's the likelihood that Russia's going to end up paying this?
Well, there's no likelihood that they will simply roll over and hand the cash over. The option then for the shareholders will be to take further legal action to see if they can get courts outside Russia to order the seizure of commercial assets that the country owns. I mean, that won't be a case of embassies or anything like that, but it is conceivable that some commercial assets could conceivably be seized and used to generate the cash to meet these claims.
Any idea how that process would work, how soon that could happen?
It takes a very long time. And if you think of what's been happening in the American courts to Argentina over a very long period, where some creditors in relation to a default on its bonds have been making efforts for several years, for many years, to try and get their money back, I think it'll be no easier for the creditors in this case to get money from Russia.
Does this decision isolate Russia even further?
You could argue that it does, I suppose. The very strong language in the ruling does emphasize to international investors the fact that Russia is very widely perceived as a very difficult place to do business, where there are really quite significant political risks involved. But at the same time, you have to recognize that people understood that anyway. Investors that get involved in Russia are typically doing it because they think the energy resources there are so large that there must ultimately be the potential to make money. But what investors can see is that the latest political developments in Russia are themselves what are sending the real, clear and present signal about Russia's isolation from the rest of the world, in particular from the West.
And at this moment, Russia's government cannot be happy with this, another round of bad publicity.
Absolutely. The Russian authorities have said that this is a flawed and politically biased ruling, and they are, they say, going to appeal it so far as there is any scope to do that. But yes, it's another very unwelcome bit of mud, if you like, sticking to the already significantly tarnished image of what you might call brand Russia.
The BBC's economics correspondent, Andrew Walker. Andrew, thanks.
My pleasure, David.
On those sanctions we talked about earlier, EU ambassadors are expected to announce the specifics tomorrow, and the U.S. has said it'll follow. There's been lots of research lately, a lot of reports on the value of a college education. So you might be surprised to learn that some colleges are actually struggling to get kids in the door. That's especially true in the Midwest because the supply of college-ready 18-year-olds is dwindling. And for schools that need those tuition dollars to keep the lights on, that's a big deal. Marketplace's Annie Baxter reports.
Tom Crady wants high school kids around the country to think about attending Gustavus Adolphus College, even if they mangle the name.
Some won't even say the name at all. They will say, how do you pronounce the college's name?
How do they mispronounce it?
It's often Gustav.
Crady is vice president of enrollment at Gustavus Adolphus. It's not that hard to say. It's a Lutheran liberal arts college perched on a bluff in southern Minnesota. The college is seeing fewer applicants from Minnesota and other Midwestern states these days, like hundreds fewer. So Crady is courting potential students from far-flung places like Texas and even India.
There are a combination of factors that are converging right now that are alarming to us.
What's alarming to Crady is a big demographic shift. In the 90s, birth rates fell nationally, On top of that, lots of people migrated south and west. That all spells a decline in high school graduates in the Northeast and Midwest today. That's according to Brian Prescott, who directs research at the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education.
You can't grow high school graduates or 18-year-olds in a laboratory.
Prescott estimates there's been a 7% drop in high school grads in the Midwest just over the past 6 years. Colleges as far away as Dartmouth and Harvard have noticed fewer applications for Midwesterners. But experts say these demographic changes are not a big deal for elite institutions that have fat endowments and kids lined up at the door. Small liberal arts colleges that are not household names will likely suffer more as tuition dollars shrink.
It's very tough right now, not only finding your high school, the number of your potential applicants dropping, but knowing that there are others competing with you to try to get those graduates.
Diane Villacava is with the credit rating agency Moody's. She says many small Midwestern colleges are struggling with the shifting demographics. Among the ones that Moody's rates, a couple dozen have seen two consecutive years of declining enrollments. Many are bumping up their recruiting budgets and offering big discounts on tuition.
What we're finding is that some of the Midwest colleges are discounting over 50% to get a student to come to their college.
That's true at Gustavus Adolphus. On average, the college cuts its $40,000 annual tuition by about half. But Villacava says as revenue falls, colleges have to figure out how to cut costs in other areas, like faculty.
Given that many of them have a somewhat inflexible expense structure, that can prove very challenging for operations.
Even some public institutions are feeling the pain. Minnesota State University Moorhead recently blamed changing demographics when it announced plans to eliminate several low enrollment programs. If there are any winners in this scenario, they may be the Midwestern high school students who are in such short supply. Braden Yell begins her senior year of high school in a St. Paul suburb this fall. On a recent visit to Gustavus Adolphus, Yell told me she's been getting a lot of love from Midwestern colleges.
Absolutely. Lots of asking for tours and stuff like that.
I asked if that made her feel like she had the upper hand.
It seems like it, but at the same time, I don't really know what I'm doing. So,
for now, though, Yell's happy with all the attention. In St. Peter, Minnesota, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Coming up,
this is graphene. Let's call him Mr. G. He is the first material that is two-dimensional.
Carbon may be cool again, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 22 points, 0.1%, to close at 16,982. The NASDAQ gave back 4 points, 0.1%, to wrap at 44.44. The S&P 500 ticked up less than 1 point, a fractional gain, to settle at 1978. Tyson Foods fluttered up 2.5% despite missing expectations on a quarterly profit. Pending home sales fell a bit in June, which knocked down home builder stocks. Lennar Corporation lost 2%. Toll Brothers declined 1.5%. KB Home subtracted 1.75%. D.R. Horton dropped 0.6%. Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase each pocketed 0.3%. Overseas, Germany's DAX retreated 0.5%. Britain's FTSE shuffled down less than 0.1%. France's CAC 40 gained 0.3%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.48%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The National Alliance to End Homelessness opens its annual conference in Washington, D.C. The Federal Reserve begins a two-day meeting on interest rates. It is one of eight regularly scheduled meetings this calendar year. And on July 29, 1981, the world watched TV. Lady Diana Spencer walked down the aisle to wed Prince Charles. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdal. Congress is getting ready to start its summer vacation. There are just a few days left before lawmakers go on their August recess. That's not a lot of time to solve what's become a huge political issue: what to do with tens of thousands of migrant children who have come to the U.S. Most of them are from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, where they've dealt with gang violence and all kinds of instability. In the U.S., it can take more than a year for a court to hear these cases. Esme Duprez has been covering the logistics of all this for Bloomberg Business Week. Hey, Esme.
Hi.
I wanted to start by asking you about how much this problem has grown over these last few years, just how many children have arrived here in the U.S. in these last couple of years. It's been a pretty stark upward trajectory.
It has. The number of unaccompanied minors, meaning kids alone with no parent or guardian, and they're mostly from Central America, it really started to jump in late 2011. But since then, the numbers have completely exploded. Border agents have detained more than 57,000 in just the last 9 months. That's more than double the number they did in all of last year. And just to put that in perspective as well, that's 10 times the amount that we saw a decade ago.
Without getting into the nitty-gritty of sort of what politicians want to spend on this issue, maybe just taking it more broadly, the solution, when you hear them talk, sounds rather simple. It's if we could send more money to the border, that would help this problem. And it really is, as you write, not as simple as that.
Yeah, I mean, money would help deal with the influx now. We're seeing shelters overwhelmed. We're seeing processing centers that are run by Border Patrol agents completely overwhelmed. You know, we're seeing courts overwhelmed as well. It's just, you know, the system is being stretched at every turn. That's part of what Obama wants to do. He wants more money to kind of help alleviate some of these bottlenecks that have been created along the way. But I have to say, frankly, there's not a lot of hope in Washington right now that Congress will actually act at all. Don't forget, they're going on break for 5 weeks on July 31st. So even if they do, you know, pass separate bills in the House and Senate, we don't know if they're going to come to an agreement and reconcile the two.
But if more money were to be approved, where would that go to if there are so many agencies working on this, if there are so many contractors working on this? Is there a sense of how that money would be spent?
So the bulk of the money that Obama requested would go to care for the newly arrived children. That would go to those shelters and kind of helping, you know, expedite the process through the shelters. A lot of it would also go to pay for detention, prosecution, and then eventually deportation. And so no matter what, I think we definitely will see more, you know, if more money gets approved, much of that will go to deportation. That's what a lot of, you know, Republicans certainly want. And Obama has even been, you know, amenable to this situation, which is to deport a lot more kids. If you can expedite their cases in courts, then you can have them in government custody or just in the U.S. for shorter. And then, you know, I mean, that's obviously going to require some money, though, because you have to have more judges. You have to, you know, have more lawyers in some case down at the border.
I think we associate this with the Border Patrol. But as you're saying, so many agencies are involved with this and private companies as well. There are a lot of people working on this issue on a day-to-day basis.
Right. One report I found said that these kids may encounter up to 15 different federal agencies while they're in the U.S. So obviously they're getting, you know, juggled around a lot. A lot of the money that, you know, those federal agencies are spending are going to private companies and contractors. That's a list that runs from American Airlines that's flying these kids to live with relatives while their court case is pending, to medical practitioners and certainly shelter providers. One thing I found that was really interesting was a lot of these kids, you know, they don't even have IDs and passports. So sometimes if border agents can't figure out how old these kids are, they actually will order up dental and bone x-rays to try to determine how old they are. So really, I mean, the money would go a long way, certainly, in taking better care of them and streamlining the process.
Esme Duprez is a reporter for Bloomberg News who's been reporting on the U.S.-Mexico border. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In March, the city of Detroit made a threat to residents who were behind on their water bills. Pay up, or we'll turn off the spigot. A few things made that threat noteworthy. For one, it applied to about half of the city's customers. Before declaring a 15-day moratorium last week, Detroit did turn off some of the taps, setting off local protests. There was grumbling from the judge overseeing the city's ongoing bankruptcy case. There was even condemnation from the UN. And one more detail, corporate customers and branches of government are also behind on their water bills to the tune of millions of dollars. Marketplace's Dan Weissman reports.
Officials say they've cut off water to almost 19,000 residents. Daryl Latimer is the Water and Sewerage Department's deputy director. He says the shutoffs were always intended as a scare tactic to combat what he calls a culture that's developed.
Since you're not cutting me off, I'm not going to pay you. And what we found when we've shed residents off, that 60% are coming in and paying.
The city could not say how many businesses have had their water shut down this year. But Latimer says he's been going after corporate deadbeats, too. Often, they're disputing part of their bill, and negotiating takes time. He says that paid off with Chrysler Group. The company gave the city a check for $2.9 million, and the city recognized that some of the properties in dispute Chrysler no longer owned. Shay Howell is a volunteer with the People's Water Board Coalition.
Many, many residents also have problems with their bills. They also have issues they'd like to talk to the water department about, and they can't even get through on the water department service lines.
She says customers report wait times of up to 4 hours on hold. Janice Beecher runs the Institute for Public Utilities at Michigan State University. She says the scale of Detroit's problems make it unusual.
What we don't have in the water sector is a really clear policy for coping with something like this. So in some ways, it's a learn-as-you-go process. I do think it will go down as a case study in this sort of problem.
Residential shutoffs are due to resume next week. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
It's rare that you hear people praising carbon, given the part the element plays in climate change. But more and more companies are eagerly promoting carbon in one specific form. It's called graphene, which is said to be the strongest, thinnest, and most flexible material ever discovered. A multi-million-dollar scramble is underway. Giant corporations, including Lockheed and Samsung, want to exploit this so-called wonder product. But it's not just big companies. Marketplace's Stephen Beard visited a British startup that's also part of that scramble.
Lots of fizzing and crackling and bubbling from the test tubes in this chemistry lab. And the same goes for the enthusiasm of the lab technicians here.
It's because it's at the cutting edge of technology. Everything's very exciting. It's a wonder material.
Rebecca Edwards of Applied Graphene Materials.
I think this is the first time we've had a material which has had a combination of properties that it has, so it's not just good at one thing, it's very good at a number of things.
Since first isolated by a British university a decade ago, graphene's been generating huge excitement. It's won a Nobel Prize for its discoverers, triggered more than $1 billion of international investment, and unleashed a cascade of promotion and hype.
This is graphene. Let's call him Mr. G. He is the first material that is two-dimensional.
One atom thick, it's the thinnest material on the planet. 100 times stronger than steel, far more flexible than rubber, the best conductor of heat and electricity, almost totally transparent and yet completely impermeable. Among the uses touted, superfast computer chips, cell phones you can roll up like a piece of paper and stuff into your pocket, and super-thin condoms. What could possibly stop graphene from revolutionising countless industries?
There's an enormous leap between what you can do in the laboratory and having a product that is technologically ready. There's a big, big gap there.
Valerie Jameson of New Scientist magazine says so far graphene's been stymied by the difficulty of making sheets and sheets of the stuff. A tiny flaw can impair the product's conductivity.
Another concern I have is that graphene will actually be very expensive to begin with. Its rival materials will just be much cheaper.
And another worry, the vast bulk of the graphite from which graphene derives naturally is in China. But back at Applied Graphene Materials, they reckon they've cracked some of those problems.
You can just see the alcohol solution feeding into the furnace unit.
The boss, John Mabbitt, shows me his company's process for growing graphene out of cheap alcohol.
And all you can see is the telltale black powder coming out the other end of the equipment.
No need to dig it out of the ground at great expense. Mabbitt says they can grow a ton of graphene a year with one relatively small piece of kit. And they're not turning out sheets of it for use in consumer electronics, so tiny flaws don't matter. They aim to use their graphene as an additive to paints and lubricants.
The impermeability of graphene makes it fantastic for stopping moisture attacking a ship's hull.
That means almost rust-proof and barnacle-free vessels.
You get a double whammy of low maintenance and improved efficiency through water, which equates to fuel saving.
graphene-coated aircraft, he says, would be both lighter and lightning-proof. He believes the range of industrial applications for graphene is enormous, not perhaps as sexy as roll-up cell phones or ultra-thin condoms, but a wonder material all the same. In Redcar, in the north of England, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note about the car service Uber. In business in major cities around the world, it lets you use a smartphone to hail a car. When you use that service, at the end of the trip, you rank your driver on a 5-point scale. That ranking determines how much business the driver gets, even if that driver can continue to drive for Uber. Well, it turns out Uber drivers also rank Uber passengers on a scale of 1 to 5, and Uber keeps that number under wraps, but the website Medium posted a workaround with a few keystrokes and some copying and pasting. You could find out how you rank. Well, Uber got wind of this and quickly closed the loophole, but not before I looked up my ranking, and not to brag, but I'm a 4.9. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 22 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ gave back 4 points, 0.1%. And the S&P 500 ticked up less than 1 point, basically ending flat. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, and Daisy Palacios. Millie Jefferson directs the show. I'm David Gura. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.